This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Today, we're talking about delivering good healthcare in difficult circumstances. And here are three words that mental health providers dread: treatment-resistant depression. For people who suffer from this, nothing is working. Not talk therapy, not medication, none of the approaches that are available now. And if you think about the scope of this problem, depression is the leading cause for disability worldwide. The World Health Organization estimates that 350 million people globally are depressed, and up to a third of them are not getting better. Over the past few weeks, we've been looking into the big challenges facing the National Institute of Mental Health. The organization is currently searching for a new director. And in this final installment of the series, reporter Audrey Quinn looks at efforts to help people with this very stubborn version of depression.
When I first saw Victoria in the clinic waiting room, she struck me as slightly familiar, like one of my friend's moms from growing up in the suburbs. A little distracted looking, well put together. Up close, she looked more tired.
I've gone to therapists and psychiatrists ever since I was 15 years old. It works maybe while I'm there and they tell me positive things, but after I leave there, it just like kind of escapes my mind and it's just like I'm back to square one.
Victoria has the kind of depression that's often called treatment resistant. It's gotten so bad she's had to go on disability. She's been unable to keep a job.
I was always a workaholic, always like good attendance, always a hard worker, but mentally I just went into a bad state.
Victoria is not her real name. We're using it to protect her privacy. She's taking part in a study at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
Do you have any questions before we begin?
No.
All right, here we go.
Greg Siegel's a professor of psychiatry at the medical center. His research staff is setting Victoria up for her fifth day of an experimental treatment. He's been working on more focused therapies for people with depression like Victoria's.
So 50% of people respond to therapy, 50% of people respond to medication. They're not necessarily the same 50%.
It seems nuts to me, though, that this is the 21st century, this is medicine, that the best we can do is tell you a treatment has a 50% chance of working.
I absolutely agree. Every other medical specialty, we give you a test, and based on the test, we give you a treatment. In psychiatry, we just don't do the tests. Part of the problem has traditionally been that we don't know what to test. We don't know the mechanisms or how the disorders work well enough to do a test. We're just starting to learn this.
Matt Rudorfer heads the Psychopharmacology and Somatics Treatment Program at the National Institute of Mental Health, the NIMH. He says being able to diagnose a patient with depression doesn't necessarily bring us any closer to knowing how to treat them.
It is simply not that kind of one-to-one relationship as, say, taking an antibiotic, you know, to attack a specific bacteria which has been identified in a laboratory.
He says a good treatment would probably only have to act in one particular area of the brain.
But A, we don't know what that area is, and B, even if we did, we have no way of directing the medication there.
Helen Mayberg is one of the pioneers of this search for a location. She's a neurologist at Emory University. She says in the past, researchers have gotten too hung up on thinking depression is all about chemical imbalances.
The brain is not a bowl of soup, and you add the chemical and you stir. Chemicals work within networks, within systems, within pathways. And where in the brain a chemical may be working is as important as knowing what chemical you should use.
She found that people with really severe depression, the kind that just wouldn't go away after other treatments, they seem to have overactivity in the part of their brain called Brodmann Area 25. That's a couple inches behind the bridge of your nose. It's an area of the brain that monitors negative emotion. And when she did deep brain stimulation of that area, basically turning down its activity, the connected areas seemed to be able to function more normally. Most of her patients who didn't get better from anything else felt better when they kept getting the deep brain stimulation there. She also uses brain scans to compare depressed people who got better with drugs and those who got better with therapy.
People that did or did not get better on drug look different from each other. People who did or did not get better on therapy look different from each other. And then the ultimate test, that people who respond to therapy have very different brain scans than people who respond to drug.
and they look different, of course, in specific parts of their brain. Greg Siegel back at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center has also been focused on Brodmann Area 25. Depressed people who have a hard time in cognitive therapy, they seem to have extra activity there in that area that monitors negative emotion.
So if you're sitting around constantly monitoring your emotion, you might not be the best candidate for an intervention that says, let's break away from that monitoring and do something about the thought.
He says what he thinks it really comes down to is an attention issue. These people are too caught up in their own negative thoughts, he calls them ruminations, to pay attention to therapy. During Victoria's test session, he explains to me a possible way around that. His lab was looking for a way they could still get the attention of someone really caught up in depression.
And it turns out just about anybody can get annoyed. So we said, let's capitalize on that and effectively annoy the depressed people to make them better.
How they do this is by putting tiny electrodes on the inside of people like Victoria's wrist, and they have her ruminate.
Right. Do they feel good now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then we will go back over and...
So in this intervention, we pass a weak current through their wrist, which kind of itches a little bit. It's a little bit annoying. And we see if they can pay attention to it. And if they can't, we can turn up the voltage so it's a little more annoying. And then they're good at paying attention.
And so it's like you're hacking their attention.
We are hacking their attention. That's exactly it. And when they can pay attention to the current at that higher voltage, we'll turn it down. And we'll keep turning it down until it's a tiny crumb of sensation. And when they can pay attention to that, then we've really hacked their attention. We've rebooted it.
The idea is after 5 sessions of this, and 5 should be enough, people should be able to pay better attention to things in the real world that they want to, like their therapy sessions.
Your brain is not a closed, immutable system. Your brain can be changed, and we can hack that.
Other researchers are trying to do this sort of thing by seeing whether we can test genetically what drugs will work for depression patients, or whether a simple questionnaire can tell you if you'll be responsive to therapy, and then to adjust a person's treatments accordingly. Victoria met with Greg Siegel in his office after her test session was over.
How was that?
It just helps me when I'm ruminating about that thought to realize that there's something going on outside of my thinking.
It'll take more time and therapy sessions to know if Siegel's intervention really improved her receptivity to therapy. But she says that feeling of having control over her ruminations, that's what she needs. As Victoria was getting ready to leave, I remembered to ask her one more biographical detail.
Do you mind if I say how old you are?
No, I don't mind. I'm 45 years old.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
I still feel like I'm 18, so I still feel like I haven't grown up. But anyways.
I didn't really respond when she said this. I figured she meant she still felt young at heart. It's something a lot of people say. The interview seemed over.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. And I don't know if maybe you want to add this, is just because of me and my, like, negative thinking from when I was so young, that I wouldn't try to, like, better myself and just thinking that I'm a bad person. And since I was always running away from feelings, it kind of kept me stuck at, like, mentally being at, like, a younger age than I actually am. So I don't know if that makes sense, but a lot of times I just feel like I'm 18 years old because, like, I'm actually starting to grow as a person.
She says even though her depression's been treatment resistant, she feels better that she's working at ways to fix that, like being in Greg Siegel's study.
Because I'm actually, like, dealing with... dealing with everyday life instead of trying to run away from it.
Siegel says if the intervention with the electrical impulses proves successful, it's something patients with depression could soon be able to do in their own homes. The study still has a few more years to go. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.